On ABC Radio across Australia, you're with Adam Shirley.
When you were young, did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do in life? Perhaps the job you always wanted to work in, the country you always wanted to travel to, the difference you always wanted to make for others. 2020's Australian of the Year is Dr. James Mukey. Born in Adelaide, raised and schooled in Canberra, then back to Adelaide for med school, journeyed through regions of Africa and Asia, in some cases with his life flashing before his eyes during some highly risky situations. The course of his existence set as he helped countless people in poor countries regain their sight. A passion for exploring some of the world's highest mountain ranges and an enduring love of medicine, always focused on the possibility of helping someone in need. Dr. James Mukey is a globally minded citizen with a locally focused attitude. And in the midst of a life providing people the ability to see, he has still so much more to give. Dr. James Mukey, congratulations on being Australian of the Year.
Thank you so much, Adam.
You've previously said working in medicine must have been in your DNA. Why have you always been drawn to it?
I have no explanation. There was no one experience that I can remember that made me want to go down a medical pathway. It just was something that I was always wanting to do. So I suspect there's some genetic element there. And it's just been the thing I wanted to always do. And I think particularly surgery. And if I look back to my early teenage years, I used to be an avid model maker. So I loved very fine work. And so microsurgery was always something that appealed to me. So then I naturally got drew towards ophthalmology with its wonderful microsurgery.
Because in your family, there is a bit of a history of learning, of working towards, I guess, bigger picture things, but not in the medical field. How did your parents and how did others react when it was clear to them this is exactly where you wanted to go?
There was no pressure on me whatsoever. And Dad was a scientist. He worked at the CSIRO. We actually moved from Adelaide to Canberra when I was five, as you mentioned. And so he was a scientist. I had an uncle who was a GP in Adelaide. But it's just this thing inside me that I suspect some inbuilt desire to want to help people that drove me that way.
Yeah, folks encourage you to go out as well, to see the world and take risks even as a young man. And some of those adventures brought you face-to-face, amongst other things, with Ugandan rebel fighters, dangerous wild animals, and a host of day-to-day challenges. How did these experiences start to shape your character into who you are today?
Those experiences are resilience building, I think, and if that would be the most profound thing that resulted from that, you know, ability to withstand some of these unexpected challenges and changes that happen in your life. So that has been very instrumental, but I've got this undying love of adventure and travel, and so it's something that even those risky things didn't quench. These days I don't really seek out risky travel experiences, but it was just one of those things, you know, when you're young you don't really consider the dangers, you're invincible. And that was my time in Africa, which was quite astonishing in terms of the risks that I put to myself.
Were you aware at that stage just how transformative that period would be?
No, I don't think I was. I was there. I think the one thing that drew me to Africa was the wildlife. And I absolutely wanted to go and experience the wildlife and then just travel to some of these exotic parts of the continent. And yes, Africa, unfortunately, there's been over those decades quite some turmoil, and some of the countries I travelled through were quite stable. Others, not long afterwards, such as Rwanda, then descended into turmoil with the horrendous genocide that happened there. So it's a very dynamic part of the world, and I don't think I realised at the time quite the extent of the danger I was putting myself in. And certainly I think my mum and dad had no idea as well. They didn't encourage me to go. In fact, I think they were a bit concerned, particularly when I wanted to take a year off medicine and to have this experience.
And letters that took weeks to get back to them to let them know that you're okay. You know, there wasn't the day and age of instant messaging, of streaming video to let them know what you were doing. What was that like in terms of developing independence while still wanting that strong connection to your folks?
Absolutely. So you mentioned I was actually captured by some rebel soldiers in Uganda, and that in itself is a story.
We should briefly mention that this was during the period that Idi Amin was trying to come back into Uganda, and these fighters were aligned with him. I mean, these were tumultuous periods.
Back then, which was in 1989, I think it was, there was, as you mentioned, there was certainly no internet, no email. It was even difficult to find somewhere where you could make a phone call home. So after that experience, when I actually arrived in Rwanda, as soon as I could, I made a phone call to Mum and Dad and said, "You're going to get a letter in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be quite confronting, but I've survived. I'm okay. Don't worry about me." But could you imagine? I mean, I've got kids now who are 20 and 23,
yes.
And our youngest went off to Vietnam just last year for an experience, and you know, we were sweating over that, you know. But I don't know how Mum and Dad felt. I should really quiz Mum about how her feelings were to see that letter.
On ABC Radio across Australia, Adam Shirley with you. Our guest is 2020 Australian of the Year, Dr. James Mukey. Ophthalmology is where you found your medical fit in the end. Was it the fine physical detail of the work, a la model building, its potential to improve quality of life, or was it other factors that made it just right for you?
I think it was a combination of all of those. I mentioned before that I had this love of model making, and so the microsurgical element of it was really something that appealed to me. I think when you go through your internship in medicine, that's the first time you get really heavy exposure to medicine and surgery. You're often influenced by the people that you're exposed to, and so some of the things that I was interested in doing, I didn't find someone, I suppose, that was inspiring me to go down that pathway. However, in ophthalmology, you know, there were characters that did inspire me to go down that pathway. So that helped to influence it. But by that stage, I'd had a medical elective at the end of fifth year in Kenya. And I loved the idea of public health, and with cataract blindness being the leading cause of blindness in the world, and yet a readily treatable condition, you know, that was something that was very appealing as well, that you could make a real difference very easily through this profession.
A clear wrong that needed to be righted and that could be righted? Was there an element of justice nearly that drew you to that placement in Kenya and the fact that things could be improved clearly?
I don't think so. I don't think I had that sense in my mind at that age of my life. What I did experience throughout my internship was a frustration with medicine, and that was really driven by the fact that I was seeing people with chronic and often self-inflicted diseases.
This is in Australia. This is so interesting that, sorry to preempt, but the frustration about people not getting better, but then having a better result with other patients overseas. Tell us more about
exactly.
That.
So you know, most of the patients you're exposed to in the public system as an intern do have chronic diseases, lung diseases, heart diseases, and back then smoking was such a huge contributor to that. And I was seeing that with medicine, you're only really alleviating people's chronic disease rather than being able to cure them. So that was one of the things that was frustrating to me. And to be honest, I was actually considering dropping out of medicine. I was actually considering dropping out of medicine to design and build furniture, which is kind of bizarre. I had this passion for furniture as well. So when I went to Kenya, and most of the diseases that I came across, and I was in a little rural hospital in the foothills of the Aberdeen Mountains in central Kenya. Yep. The diseases I was treating there were mainly infectious, and so patients rarely got better. And that was a quite refreshing experience for me. And that then did drive me back to want to continue to do medicine, and particularly to pursue a career in public health. And it's really done a full circle now, because I realise that so many of these diseases are preventable, and the solution is often quite simple. And so it's been quite, and it really, you know, in a sense, something that's come to me in more recent years as I've matured, I suppose. I think prevention to me has become something I'm much more passionate about now. Also, some of the experiences I've had as an ophthalmologist and working in poorer countries, where a lot of the blinding conditions that I've come across, particularly in kids, are entirely preventable, such as, you know, measles, lack of vaccination, malnutrition, even a lack of spectacles, because lack of availability of something that we take for granted back here.
You're listening on ABC Radio across Australia, and you're listening with 2020's Australian of the Year. Dr. James Mukey is a passionate medical practitioner, a doctor, an ophthalmologist, and a humanitarian. And I want to ask you about that, well, crucial phase, really, James, in Myanmar, seeing young children going blind because of measles. That was a very distressing experience for you. Tell us how upsetting it was being confronted with the suffering of those children.
Absolutely. That was the biggest and most powerful experience. I've had a number of experiences on this journey which have kept me continuing down this pathway of working in poorer countries and public health. But that really was one of the most profound. So I was involved in a childhood blindness study in Myanmar in 2007, and we found that nearly half of all kids had blindness that could have been prevented or treated. That in itself was, you know, confronting. But to find that measles was the leading cause of blindness for those kids was something quite horrendous. The schools for the blind, which is where we based our studies, like schools here, the children are admitted about the age of five. So the kids were already blind and irreversibly blind. And measles actually blinds in a very disfiguring, and I can't imagine the pain that these kids would have gone through. It probably, most of these cases would have happened, you know, in the first or second year of life. So the kids were coming to the school for the blind and they were already irreversibly blind, but very disfigured. And it's as I mentioned, it's hard to imagine the pain that those poor kids have went through. So every school for the blind that we visited in that country, and also we found many kids with measles blindness in Cambodia and Laos as well when we did our studies in those countries. It was very distressing for myself and for my colleagues that were involved. And every evening we got back at the end of the day and we were just, you know, head in hands and just devastated by what we were experiencing.
How do you go on when every night, as you say, you're head in hands, distressed, really upset because you can see these kids suffering?
You then start to think, okay, what am I going to do about this? How can I help to reverse this problem? And at the time, there was no trained pediatric ophthalmologist or children's eye specialist, someone who could not only treat the blinding diseases of childhood but advocate for children with blinding yet preventable diseases such as measles. So when I came home and we wrote the paper up and we collated the results, and then I subsequently went back and met with the health minister, and I actually put the paper on his lap and he looked at it and read the conclusions and the results and said, he looked up at me and said, I thought we were doing better than that. And so he immediately endorsed our desire to train a pediatric ophthalmologist for the country. And that same week when I was in Myanmar, I took the paper to UNICEF, who were running the measles vaccination program at the time. Mm-hmm. And they then also vowed to scale up the whole measles vaccination program. So that study was very, very instrumental.
Should be said too, this was during the period of military junta rule, was it not? So this, the background to all this work was also very turbulent.
It was, and actually at the time, to be able to undertake a study, and a medical study in Myanmar, was not easy. And I think one of the colleagues in Myanmar was the ophthalmologist for the head of the head of the country, and I think that helped pave our way. And actually, we had undertaken a study a couple of years before in 2005, an adult blindness study in a regional area of the country. And we discovered an incredibly high prevalence of blindness, still to this day, one of the highest prevalences of blindness. That also drove a lot of our work towards fighting adult blindness in that country.
You managed to train up a local ophthalmologist, and he, I think you've said before, was quite a character, an inspirational local for all the other locals. And then thousands and thousands of children who previously hadn't had that critical eye care were getting it. Could you have hoped for a better result?
No, he's our poster boy, to be honest. He is an extraordinary character in himself. In fact, I'm currently doing a documentary about him, and next week I'm heading back to finish the documentary. His name is Tan Tuan Ong, and he was a young ophthalmologist, really just finished his training. He was involved in that adult blindness study that we were a part of, and we already knew that this guy was a gun. He was something special. And so he was the one that put his hand up to come to Australia to train. And so he came and spent a year with us in Adelaide at the Women's and Children's Hospital, hands-on. So this was a hands-on training. He was an already trained ophthalmologist. However, we took him and myself and my colleagues trained him over a year at the Women's and Children's Hospital. And he went back in 2010 as the first in his country. Daunting task ahead of him. I think there was probably close to 20 million kids in that country. There was no expertise really to be able to treat these diseases of childhood. And he took it on. In that 10-year period, he is now treating close to 30,000 kids every year. That's him and his small group of trainees that he's training. In 2015, he finished training the second paediatric ophthalmologist for the country using the expertise that he'd acquired in Australia. And he now trains, I think, two or three every year. So the scalability of the work we do, that's just one example of close to 100 specialists that we've trained across Asia over the last couple of decades. So, yeah.
It provides a good example, though, to what we'll talk about soon, and that is Sight for All and that idea of teaching and spreading the knowledge locally. Clearly, the rest of your life's course had been set there.
Well, I go back all the time. I'm going through an interesting phase in my life that I've actually have a neurological disability, which I inherited from my father, and it's called focal dystonia. And in 2016, I had to finish operating. It's a two-handed job, and fortunately a lot of my profession is non-surgical work, so I've still been able to continue working and function quite comfortably and quite safely. So unfortunately the surgical side of what I was involved in has waned, of course. However, we now have something like 130 specialists from across this country, also internationally, who are involved in our program. So I don't have to be that person on the ground training anymore. I've able to coordinate these programs, and I have a great team behind me now who are helping with this. To have people who are embracing this and enthusiastic about it, that's a very special thing. And I know when I mentioned Tan Tonong, this pediatric ophthalmologist in Myanmar, a lot of his young colleagues are wanting to do pediatric ophthalmology because of the example he set. Right. And he's really made that subspecialty very attractive in his country. And so I think having inspiring figures is very important in any profession.
I wonder, every time you leave some of these countries, just how much you still have a sense of regret, of concern perhaps, that there's so much more still to do, because that must be a tough mental balancing act to make every time you go.
It is, and I am usually on the plane home. I'm writing my report out for the team and share with the team and all of the recommendations and thoughts I've had. So every time I go, or every time one of my colleagues go, we just get a whole bunch of recommendations and suggestions. So we're constantly building and thinking about it, which is a great thing, actually. So it's a very dynamic thing. So, for example, if we can bring a young ophthalmologist to Australia to train, that's fantastic, that's really powerful. But there are a number of countries where we've not been able to bring them to Australia, so we actually take teams of subspecialists to those countries to train. And so in Cambodia and Laos, through that process, so we've actually done the training on the ground with our colleagues in their own centres. And there's each time one of my colleagues goes, they come back and there's a report, and we're able to act on what they've discovered during their week or two of training and build on that. So it's as I mentioned, it's a dynamic process. We're constantly building and innovating and solving challenges and problems that we're facing and our colleagues are facing. So it's really allowing us to fine-tune the training and improve on the training.
A man who's always motivated, who always is looking to the next improvement or change he can make. You're listening to the Australian of the Year for 2020, Dr. James Mukey. Adam Shirley with you on ABC Radio across Australia. You estimate that in any given week, you give 30 hours plus to your not-for-profit organisation, Sight for All. I wonder how you manage that with all your other personal and professional commitments, James.
Yeah, it's I wonder myself sometimes, actually. And before I gave up surgery, which I mentioned 2016, it was quite a task. But what's happened over the last few years, as Sight for All has grown and become more consuming, and the fact that I've actually had to give up my surgical lists, I have more time, of course. So that's been quite fortuitous that, okay, the surgery's gone. However, I've been able to replace it with more and more time to devote to Sight for All and the work that we're doing there. But prior to giving up surgery, when did I squeeze all of this into my life? I'm an early waker. You guys got me up at 4:30 this morning to be here. And
didn't need to set the alarm?
I did need to set the alarm because I went to bed at 2:30. So yes, we were celebrating last night, of course. So I've had a couple of hours sleep, but oh, goodness. But generally, I'm an early waker, and I'll do an hour or two before I start work or before the rest of the family wakes up. So I get quite a bit done at that time of the day. I squeeze in a lot of business in between patients. So I'm often responding to emails and taking phone calls, making phone calls between patients. in the evening, sometimes if my wife goes to bed early, I'll do a bit more work. And then I've always had a day off, so I always had that day to dedicate to Sight for All and the work we were doing even prior to establishing Sight for All. But now I have, you know, most weeks I have about 3 days off a week. And so, you know, this is an all-consuming beast. It really is. It's fabulous, but it's I've always called it my second full-time job.
How do you manage to compartmentalize things so quickly but so clearly? Because I would imagine for a lot of people it would all become one big muddle.
Yeah, I think, and I have no explanation for that. And I have a switching process or mechanism in my brain that allows me to go literally from one thing to the next. And prior to Sight for All, I was actually making music. I had a computer and a keyboard synthesizer, and I was making music. And so when I got up in the morning, I used to spend an hour or two making music, which was a wonderful thing to do. But then I'd be able to switch that off and then go and work as an ophthalmologist, and then but also squeezing in some of the work that we were doing in Asia between at other times as well. So there was some process or mechanism in my brain that's allowed me to do that. No explanation for that, but I feel very fortunate that I have that ability. It just allows me to, as you say, compartmentalize and move from one thing to the next without actually blurring the margins too much. Having said that, when I was making music, I'd go off to the operating theater and I have this song going around in my head and voices and vocals and all sorts of things, words going around in my head. So, but that was it was a nice thing. That was a very positive thing.
Wonder if the surgeon's assistants ever caught you humming a few bars of your latest composition?
I don't know. I don't think so.
You've sized up excess sugar as something of a public enemy. You spoke about it last night in your speech. How do Australians need to change our relationship with sugar?
Yeah. So I think myself as an ophthalmologist and many of my medical colleagues are seeing the complications of diabetes. I don't want to see the complications of diabetes, which is a blinding disease. It's not only a blinding disease. Yes, it's a deadly disease. It's now the sixth biggest killer in this country. It's a growing epidemic. We've seen a fourfold increase in diabetes. And when I say diabetes, I'm really referring to type 2 diabetes, which makes up about 90% of all diabetes. So this is a significant problem. Nearly one in every 10 Australians have diabetes now. So I don't want to see complications of diabetes. I don't want to see people who are blind and losing vision, which I'm seeing more and more of every year. So we have to say, well, what's actually the underlying cause? And we have to go back to that and say, you know, how can we prevent it? And it should be as simple as saying, okay, reduce our intake of sugar, refined carbohydrates, highly processed foods, and there's your solution. I mean, it should be as simple as that. But
why do you think it's not?
There are other factors that are really driving this, and I call it the five A's of sugar toxicity. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I've come up with this little scheme in my head of how we can think about this. And as I say, I call it the five A's of sugar toxicity. If we think back 300 years ago, sugar was a rare commodity and it was expensive and rarely available. However, over the next 300 years, there was a rising availability and popularity of sugar, which led to diminishing costs. So now sugar is ubiquitous, sugar is cheap, we find it everywhere. And so that is the accessibility factor. So you walk into a service station and the first thing you see is the wall of chocolates and confectioneries. You check out at the supermarket and there you have half-price chocolates at the cash register. So we just, you know, this accessibility factor, which is the first A. The second A is addition. So roughly 75% of our food and drinks have added sugar. I'm not sure if people are aware of that. And then we are bombarded by advertising for sugar every day of our life. So that's the third A. And all of these things, I believe, are driving the fourth A, which is addiction. You know, I believe many of us are addicted to sugar. It's a highly addictive substance. It's been shown to be as addictive as nicotine. And so I think this is something probably people aren't aware of. And the fifth A is we're using sugar to alleviate stress and make us feel better when we're down. So those are the five A's, which do make it a very difficult habit to kick. So any strategy that really needs to deal with sugar and diabetes has to address each of these strategies.
It's a big picture fight to pick, if I could put it in a loose way. There are powerful lobbying interests in those industries here.
Absolutely.
In Australia. How much are you anticipating that for the next 12 months in what you want to do to reduce our reliance on sugar?
It is a frightening prospect, actually. But I think that there has to be a number of strategies to really address this problem, and I certainly don't feel it can be solved in a year. This is something that's sort of decades. It's decades in the making. It's 40 years in the making, a little like smoking. It was a long time coming and a long time realizing how dangerous cigarette smoking was, and then it's taking a long time to turn that around. But cigarette smoking and smoking-related diseases and deaths are on the decline in most countries. Now what we're seeing is diabetes rising and really taking its place. And I mentioned it's the sixth leading cause of death in our country. It's the seventh leading cause of death in the world. If we also look at the top causes of death, stroke and cancer, diabetes has a role to play in that. So this is a long, slow process, and I think we're going to have to see lots of innovation. We're going to have to see lots of resilience, particularly by potential industries that might be impacted by this.
Adam Shirley with you on ABC Radio across Australia. Our guest is the 2020 Australian of the Year, Dr. James Mukey.
Now, if we look at those five A's of sugar toxicity, how are we going to deal with this? So if we look at accessibility, I think we need to move sweet products away from checkout counters. I mean, that's an obvious start, and I think, you know, businesses can surely embrace that. I think that's something that can be done. If we look at the addition of sugar to foodstuffs, people have that choice, right? You know, I try and look at those nutritional labels on food packets, and I can barely read them, let alone understand them, and I don't know how most people would actually understand. So I think a clearer labeling system of the sugar content. The sugar content in foodstuffs is really important, so that people can look at a glance, and perhaps a traffic light system might be a way of doing it. You know, red, high sugar, don't buy. Yellow, think twice. Green, safe. You can do it. Advertising. I think we need to pull back from time and space for advertising for sweet products, particularly during kids' TV. So those are the three things I think that we can do, and governments can do to address this problem. The things that we can do personally are being aware of the addictive nature of sugar. I wasn't aware of it until relatively recently in my life. And also that we're using sugar to alleviate stress and make us feel good. So if people are aware of that, then they can start to come up with other strategies. The actual coming off of sugar, detoxing from sugar, isn't fun. But it's not a impossible process. And that's a big discussion in itself. But I think also just the awareness of, rather than reaching for a chocolate bar when you're feeling down, go for a walk, go for a cycle, listen to some music. They all activate the reward center in our brain, the same reward center that sugar activates, releasing the neurotransmitter dopamine. Do something positive and healthy rather than reaching for something that's actually potentially killing us.
It's clear this is a year in which you'll use your platform to advocate about the damage sugar can do, and to try and change that whole picture. What other areas might you try and address with the title Australian of the Year?
Well, one of the things I want to do, and I think that should be very easy to achieve, and it's something that I've not once seen on TV, is any awareness strategies to let us know about the underlying dietary cause of type 2 diabetes. I've never seen anything. And people need to be aware that this is a preventable disease, and if you have type 2 diabetes, it's also potentially reversible. So it's not a hopeless situation, which I think in the past most people with diabetes felt that was the case. So I think we need awareness strategies, which on one hand warn people of the complications of diabetes. And we did create an ad which played nationally on Channel 7 a year ago, featuring Neil, the man that we met last night at the awards ceremony, who suddenly went blind at the age of 50 overnight in both eyes from his diabetes. His story is incredibly powerful. So I think people need to be aware of these risks, but at the same time realize that actually we don't need to get diabetes in the first place. And here are the strategies that we can take to lower our risk of doing it, and it's not a difficult concept for anyone to get their heads around.
It is a big discussion and ambition that you have to change the way that diabetes and sugar affects us in Australia, but you've taken on big challenges before and been successful. It is a great pleasure to meet you and speak with you, Dr. James Mukey, and thank you very much for being generous with your time on ABC Radio today.
Lovely to be here, and thanks so much.